Sí.
Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Socey. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog which you can check out at filmsociology.tumblr.com. Kobe Slagle might be joining us near the end of the show. Everybody, ladies and gentlemen, is trying to work in ahead of time so we can enjoy the holidays with our families and not be here. But who knows? We will see. Sitting in with us today from the Film Yap, from Indie Style, and from the IFJA, that's the Indiana Film Journalists Association, Chris Lloyd. How are you, sir?
Good to see you. You forgot to mention the Sarasota Herald Tribune.
Oh, I'm sorry. No disrespect to the Sarasota folk.
And the Kern in Noblesville and the Ocala Star Banner and the Gainesville Sun. I am Mr. All Over the Place.
Fine. Chris Lloyd, jerk of all trades. good to have you here. And right now we are in the midst of grown-up movie season. Full disclosure, tomorrow, if you're listening to this on Friday, tomorrow is the big IFJA meeting. Ooh, we will be in a hidden bunker on the west side where there will be chicken strips and other bar food, and we will break down our awards. It's like Con at 68. It's brutal. It's absolute bloodshed will happen, and we will have the announcements on Monday morning. So we will inflict this on the Indiana Press Monday morning. So you will see.
Yes, we'll disseminate it far and wide, although not via the Associated Press, who informed me today that they don't publish things like that. Thanks.
Really?
Thanks, AP Indianapolis. Apparently, you've got better things to do.
Good luck with it. So we will check the headlines on Monday and see what trumped us out. There better be an explosion. No, we're not wishing that would happen. And if there is one, we had nothing to do with it. It's been a fun week. People kind of make fun of critics all the time because we're low-hanging fruit. I understand that.
And we deserve it.
And probably deserve it. But this is the season where we're trying to gather up stuff for the end of the year. Chris and I, as well as our colleague Ed Johnsonat, are going to be on No Limits here on WFYI on December the 23rd, I believe. So we'll be talking about movies then if you want to call in. But the combination of press screenings, and sometimes we've had two a day, and sometimes three in a day, as well as screeners that are sent to the house, films that we can watch online, all of this so we can hopefully have a more solid list of films that we can consider for award consideration.
Yeah, so we're seeing Annie tomorrow morning right before our meeting, and so after that I will have watched 16 movies in the previous week, or actually in the previous 6 days. So, yeah, there's a point in which even we get like...
It's a job.
Yeah. It becomes, I've not seen anything that I hated during this time.
Which helps. That really helps.
Yeah. That does help. I've been disappointed a couple times. I've been pleasantly surprised a few times. But in general, it's kind of been like in the groove, you know, that, you know, the general quality of filmmaking this time of year is more ambitious than it reflects on what we've seen.
And this is something that we have to remember when we start slugging through films that are opening in January and February and August and September, and you know, when we're like 0-5.
Yeah.
So this balanced that out. So opening in theaters today, we have two big titles and then a smaller title, but anyway, so one of the things that happened is because besides all the award screeners that we have and watching, folks like Chris and I, we also have families. So it's trying to get a little bit of time in. And sometimes, like I said, there's two films that are opening, two considerably different films. And it got to be, well, which one of these do I want to see? And from process of elimination. So I got to see Top 5. You saw Exodus, not a remake of the Paul Newman movie from 1960.
No.
But shorter.
believe it or not, it actually is shorter.
It is shorter than Otto Preminger's 1960 version of that. But you saw it. It's Christian Bale, John Turturro, Joel Edgerton, Sigourney Weaver, Ben Kingsley.
Many of those, by the way, playing Egyptians.
And so now we get the angry letters from the Egyptian film community.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, in terms of political correctness, you know, I'm one of those, you know, always take the left turn you know, whatever people say are politically correct, I try to go against it just to peeve them off because, you know, they deserve it.
So Omar Sharif not in this film, but he's his own country.
Yeah, but you know, Yul Brynner at least was naturally, you know, a dusky fellow.
What is he?
Joel, I think he was actually like, wasn't he like a Russian Jew, but he had some more varied backgrounds. I think, you know, he actually had some non-white boy genes, so, whatever the proper
but
terminology
that sounds like,
is.
That sounds like when you say, my family's 1/16th this, so I know.
Yes, it's the Elizabeth Warren standard.
Right.
You know, 1/32nd qualifies you as part
as
of that
expert.
Demographic. But, yeah, Joel Edgerton as Pharaoh Ramses and Sigourney Weaver as the mother.
More believable family pool than, say, Alexander?
Probably.
Okay.
Yeah. And John Turturro as the previous Pharaoh. I mean, even my non-PC skin starts to crawl a little bit at that stuff.
But wouldn't you say this is a throwback to the 50s where you just got English actors and Euro actors and throw them in there and that's that?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember.
Those great Roman actors in Spartacus.
Yeah, well, that's like just a preview of Into the Wild, which is not until next week, but a movie, you know, where it's just like, hey, I know we all live in the same fictional medieval village, but some of us have British accents and some of us have American accents and some of us are Germans pretending to be Americans.
And did you mean Into the Woods?
Into the Woods. Isn't that what I said?
No, you said Into the Wild.
Into
the
Wild.
We already reviewed that. And we reviewed Wild, but that's another time.
Different movie. Different
right,
time.
Much different movie. So tell us about Exodus. This is a story that's been told before.
Yeah. So it's, you know, directed by Ridley Scott, one of my favorite directors, which is not to say that he's not made some turkeys.
His third sword film.
Yeah, Gladiator, and what was the other one?
Kingdom of Heaven.
Oh yeah,
and I guess if you want, I guess fourth if you really want to count Legend.
Yeah,
four.
Kinda,
so
yeah.
Okay,
more fantasy,
but they're pushing this as from the director of Gladiator.
Yeah, it's a huge movie. It's one of those movies where, you know, they spend a ton of money on it, and as the old saw goes, every dollar is up there on the screen. It's a great looking movie, tons of extras, tons of CGI, battle scenes. Very expertly, technically well-made film. They try and do some interesting things from it, you know, in terms of, you know, not being the Ten Commandments and having all the hokiness. The main thing is, you know, the Moses and Ramses characters. You know, Ramses, you know, instead of being the hissable villain from the Yul Brynner days, he's actually almost this passive, even somewhat sympathetic character. Who, you know, all this terrible stuff is happening and he doesn't really seem to understand it. And the Moses character, on the other hand, is also more passive. You know, it's not him, you know, throwing down his rod and turning it into a, you know, viper and that kind of stuff. Or was it an asp?
That's all right.
I can't remember. I just wanted to say asp.
You did.
On air.
Twice. Thank
but,
you.
But, you know, it's more like he's communing with God through this messenger who appears to him as this young boy with mangy hair and scratches on his face. And it's more like, you know, if I don't convince Ramses to let my people go, all this stuff will happen. So it's less like these two in opposition to each other and more like all this biblical stuff is going on and they're sort of, you know, representing each side without necessarily being the fomenter of the actual events.
So who did Ridley Scott cast as Edward G. Robinson and Vincent Price?
Okay, yeah. The Edward G. Robinson with the classic line of, you
where's
know, where's your
I?
Moses now? Which he never actually says
no,
in the movie.
He doesn't. I know. But it's become, it's like Judy and your dirty rat of...
What I'd say about this movie is it's the spectacle without the spectacular. It just kind of ends up being a bit of a flat movie, a little bit disappointing. It's long, but not super long. I think it's about 2 hours, 23 minutes. Feels a bit longer. The Christian Bale character doesn't really work for me, what they're trying to do with Moses. Turning him into an action hero.
Like Noah earlier this year.
It really is kind of the same thing. It's like there's a spiritual side and the contemplative side. But for the most part, he's a two-fisted, burly guy out to make stuff happen. And
don't walk in his eye line.
Yeah. I didn't find it very compelling. You know, there's a lot of good stuff in there, and I think people who want a good old ripping action film will probably like it more than people who want the hokey drama with, you know, Charlton Heston and all that stuff.
Yeah, no Heston in this one, but and Ridley Scott gets to make another big movie.
He does. So it's one of those ones. I mean, you know, the Ten Commandments, I actually featured it on the Fill Me Up not too long ago in our Reeling Backward column, which I basically said it's an enjoyable film, but, you know, it's just a big old slice of ham.
With a glazed pineapple on top.
Yeah, I mean, it's so cheesy. My favorite part in the Ten Commandments is, you know, where he carves the actual Ten Commandment tablets and, you know, comes down from the mountains and, you know, and sees all the idolatry and all that and, turns the Ten Commandment tablets into a missile to destroy Edward G. Robinson, and he explodes and a pit in the ground opens up and he falls into it. And then in the last scene of the movie, they have to come up with this lame excuse for why we have the Ten Commandment tablets back to us in the Ark, because they were restored to us. Absolutely cheesiest movie moment in a big cheese.
And yet every Easter on ABC, every Easter you get to experience that.
Yeah.
It's funny, sidestepping a little bit. I just got done directing It's a Wonderful Life at Anderson University. Big shout out to my cast and crew. And one of my goals now is I want to do It's a Wonderful Life in a non-December month.
Yeah.
Because it has been lumped as a Christmas film.
Yeah.
Yes, there's Christmas moments. Well, okay, a lot of it's Christmas. But I think life-affirming and, you know, enjoying life for what it is, you can do that any time of the year. And partly because NBC shows It's a Wonderful Life every December, or like right after Thanksgiving. By that same rationale, that means The Wizard of Oz is a Thanksgiving movie, which is ludicrous, and The Ten Commandments is an Easter movie,
yeah,
which it isn't. But, you know, you can watch those films anytime now. So, anyway, I'm glad you brought up The Ten Commandments, and this one's still shorter than that. So, but barely. Okay, you got to see Exodus, and honestly, I'm glad you did, because I was just not ready for it. I saw the new film written, directed, and starring Chris Rock, called Top Five.
Yeah.
And looking at this, Rock plays a movie star who was a comedian, and Chris Rock has made his own Stardust Memories.
Yeah.
Not 8 and a Half, which is what Stardust Memories was inspired by, thank you, Woody, but his own Stardust Memories of he's engaged to a reality star played by Gabrielle Union, and they're filming the marriage, the wedding, on Bravo. And yes, Bravo is in the lower right-hand corner at times. And he's also out promoting his new movie, which is a serious slave rebellion drama that nobody is going to see, but he's still working his tail off to get the word out. And he meets a New York Times reporter played by Rosario Dawson, and don't we wish all reporters look like Rosario Dawson, and Chris Lloyd, for that matter.
That would be an interesting person who looked both like Rosario Dawson and me. I'm not sure I'd want to.
That's a gene pool we're not going to get
into. That person who would be very lonely all their life.
Not if you're Rosario Dawson.
Well,
anyway,
the Dawson half
will be fine. But so as I watched this, I remember seeing the trailers for this, and I wondered if they were going after one particular person, because my first thought was it's kind of a dig on Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
Well, fortunately, it's not about just him. It reminded me of when we watched, I recently showed my daughter All That Jazz. And as we watched it, occasionally we would just lean over and go, so not Bob Fosse. So it's like, or Missy Pyle and Gone Girl. So not Nancy Grace. This is not the case in this. I mean, you could say it's a little bit of Chris Rock, a little bit of Eddie Murphy, a little bit of Adam Sandler, a little bit of Jim Carrey. But what it addresses is his character, who started out as a stand-up comic, but he doesn't want to do stand-up anymore. And he made these ridiculous comedies. And this one, he's the star of a franchise of movies where he is a cop who's also a bear.
Yeah, he dresses up as a bear.
Bear, and he has teamed up with Luis Guzman. And, the film's made like $600 million, and he's made three of them. And one of the recurring themes is it's shot in New York, and people are constantly calling him Hammy, whether you can see them or not, you know, like if he's crossing the street or something. So, you know, the public's view of celebrity is also addressed on this. The comic who wants to do a dramatic role. And sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. So there's a lot of ideas thrown in here. And of course, when he meets Rosario Dawson, sparks fly as far as chemistry, and is, you know, he's kind of fed up with the idea of being married on television. And and by the way, we were talking that film critics are low-hanging fruit. Reality celebrities, lower-hanging fruit. The film's not perfect. It's a long day in the life with a few flashbacks. He's sober. Rosario's character is sober. We find out how he hit rock bottom. There's a slew of cameos. Chris Rock pulled a lot of favors. He was like Jon Favreau in Chef, just going through his Rolodex going, come in here and do a couple days. Because Cedric the Entertainer is in here with a really bizarre flashback involving Cedric and Chris Rock and two groupies in a hotel room, and I'll just leave it at that. There's a scene at a bachelor party, which is, of course, is being filmed by Bravo, and there's cameos by Jerry Seinfeld, Adam Sandler, and Whoopi Goldberg. So Chris obviously pulled a lot of favors. Good for him on that. I liked, for the most part, what he was trying to get at as far as those parts of celebrity and those parts of an artist's plight of wanting to not be pigeonholed, wanting to do your own work. And there's a fun scene where he's made this film about a slave rebellion that it is opening that day. And nobody's going to see it. In fact, he goes to a multiplex, and there's a huge line, and it's for the new Tyler Perry movie, which apparently is called Boo, and it's Madea in a haunted house. Tracy Morgan's in this as well. There's a few moments that you do see them kind of riffing. Top five comes from one of the recurring moments that happens throughout the film is people have to name their top five rappers of all time. We won't do that here. But there's also a great moment of what could have happened to Tupac Shakur if he had lived. And one half of the other, and this is from a sequence where Rox goes to visit his family. Ben Vereen has a nice cameo, and then there's all of his relatives in one apartment, including Tracy Morgan. And on one half, they said, well, Tupac could have been a politician, or he would have been the bad guy in a Tyler Perry movie.
Yeah.
He'd have been the guy, as Chris Rock, he'd have been the guy that kicked Jill Scott down a flight of stairs.
Yeah.
So there is some riffing on it. It's, again, not perfect. And there's some moments, especially there's a scene, without giving away too much, that the Chris Rock character has a major moment happen on camera in front of TV. And what became a huge paparazzi moment one time doesn't happen when he's leaving a particular jail. Doesn't happen. So it's fun. It's and it possibly could be, I think, Chris Rock's best work.
Really?
But that's kind of, no disrespect toward Chris Rock, but he's one of those comics like Murphy, like Pryor, like Sandler, that they can, for the most part, for their films, you only get to see a fraction of what they could really do on stage. And I think Chris Rock is a great stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
And the films he's done have not been particularly strong.
Yeah, Chris Rock's film career is really interesting and frustrating, probably, you know, as much for us as for him, in that... you know, I remember when, you know, like 15, 17 years ago, when like, you know, Adam Sandler and him were both, you know, kind of really becoming big. You know, I was just like, I don't understand why Adam Sandler, I said to people at the time, I was like, I don't understand why Adam Sandler is a big movie star and Chris Rock is not. I mean, to me, one is exponentially more talented than the other. Neither is a particularly good actor, although they can be very good in particular roles like Sandler and Punch Drunk Love, and Rock's been good in a few things when he's been asked to... When he's been asked to do things other than be Chris Rock,
right?
Which
is
not too often.
And that happens with a lot of comics, whether it was Carrey or Sandler, where you have maybe a young or inexperienced director or a friend of theirs that just rolls the camera and says, do stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you actually have... So I'm going through Chris's... Wow.
Yeah.
His first... Okay, I'm going to... going back to the films, because the first thing, of course, a lot of people saw him in was he had a bit in I'm Gonna Get You Sucka, followed by New Jack City. Those were back-to-back, 88 and 91, but Crush Groove, Beverly Hills Cop 2. But CB4, which was kind of fun, it was the better of the rap parody films. There was also Fear of a Black Hat. He was in Panther, Sergeant Bilko, Moving Up is the supporting guy, Beverly Hills Ninja, was a voice in Dr. Dolittle, got a big push for being in Lethal Weapon 4. Because you needed another Lethal Weapon film. Was in Dogma, was in Nurse Betty. Nurse Betty was pretty good for a Neil LaBute film. And then Down to Earth, which was his first kind of starring role. And then Pootie Tang, Osmosis Jones, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, Bad Company. I hated Bad Company. Head of State, the remake of The Longest Yard. He was caretaker in that. I Think I Love My Wife, which he also directed, as well as Head of State. Let's see, going through smaller Death at a Funeral, the English version, the American version, I should say, Grown Ups, 2 days in New York. I'm going through stuff that he's not a major player in. Grown Ups 2, of course, and Top 5. Yeah, not the greatest resume in the world, but lots of people saw it.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, this movie that he's making now. You know, we see a lot of this, you know, where comedians don't want to be comedians anymore. They don't want to be stand-ups anymore. They don't want to do something else besides comedic roles. You know, here we're seeing the movie about that process as opposed to them actually trying to do it, like Jim Carrey with Man in the Moon or other things like that.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, I think it's great for any artist, you know, to aspire to do something. You know, I think aspiring to do something just because it's not what they're currently doing is a pretty terrible reason to try and do something. It's like, well, I want to do that because I've been doing this and I'm really successful at it, and so I just want to try something else just to, I don't know. To me, you'd have more of an impetus than that, like a reason, a desire. Like, I'm doing this because I want to make this movie, not because it's like I want to be serious in a movie. And it's really funny to me whenever I hear artists, whether they're filmmakers or songwriters or whatever, you know, that anyone in the artistic spectrum who says, like, you know, well, I wanted to do this because I'm known for X, and even though I'm good at it, I wanted to try Y just because, you know, that's what I really want to do or whatever. And I guess my response to that is, you know, 98% of the American workforce is doing a job they don't want to do because that's what they have to do to, you know, get groceries and stuff.
Right.
I've never had too much sympathy for comedians saying, I want to be serious just because I want to be, you know, be a dramatic actor.
So I mean, you didn't care for Bill Murray's The Razor's Edge?
Not Razor's Edge, but see, his other stuff that, you know, that he's done and been nominated for, and, you know,
and
Saint Vincent is among my top three films this year.
Top three?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
My top, right now, there's still a few things to see. Right now, I won't give it away for,
yeah, please.
I'll save it for John Kroll's show next week.
Well, no, we're going to talk about this on next week's show as well. But
yeah.
And by the way, it should be mentioned, today is Kobe's birthday.
Yes.
Maybe that's the real reason why he's not here. And also, this might be a film sociology first, because next week's show, Kobe is going to be on vacation. I'll probably be recording a summary. But next week is my birthday. So,
awesome.
Yeah, birthday month here at Film Sociology. But I remember with Razor's Edge, because that nobody expected that to happen, and nobody really wound up seeing it. And that was the deal that Murray had with Columbia was, I'll do Ghostbusters, but you got to let me do this remake of The Razor's Edge.
Here, I think the thing is, I mean, if you look at the stuff that Murray's done over the last 12, 15 years that people have really liked, I would argue those have almost all been comedy roles. They've been black comedies.
They've been,
but like Lost in Translation.
But it's not the goofy
Broken Flowers.
Yeah, not.
I mean, to me, those are black comedies. They're not straight drama like you know Paul Newman, The Verdict. You know, where there's not a wink of irony or fun or humor in that. Whereas I think Razor's Edge, I think that was him trying to do a straight drama, and I don't think it really worked. I think comedy is his wheelhouse, and, you know, he can do massive graduations of comedy from light and frothy and Ghostbusters to, you know, black, pitch black comedy, but I think he's still a comedic actor.
Sure, and if you can use some of that to, you know, have those light moments in a drama, this week we watched, and I just watched it for a second time, I showed it with my family, but The Skeleton Twins.
Yeah.
Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig are both really good in that, and there are some, you know, Emma, the 13-year-old, it's a dramedy. So for what, you know, that you see that section in the video store if there were still video stores, but being able to use some comedic chops in some light moments that are needed in that film and or any serious film for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe it's just because of his recent passing, but you know, Robin Williams to me was kind of the king of that, and that, you know, he could. He's one of the few comedians that I felt really could segue into absolutely straight drama and do it well. I mean, and granted, a lot of his stuff is like Murray's. There's still a comedic edge to it. I mean, even in Good Will Hunting, there's a little bit of, you know, irony.
The bit about his wife and passing gas.
Yeah. I mean, there's, the, you know, he cannot ever completely escape the orbit, you know, of comedy. You know, it's like he can... He can ping around the solar system, but he can't leave our solar system and go to another one.
And that's why I think also when he did Dead Poets Society, where, because, you know, that was his, I don't know if it was immediate follow-up to Good Morning Vietnam. Good Morning Vietnam was one of the best examples of just, that's a good example of letting the camera roll. And that's what Barry Levinson did during the radio parts. Not the whole film, but the radio parts. And with Dead Poets Society, he had moments. You know, he impersonates Brando and John Wayne and you know, stuffy English actors for some classroom sessions. But rest of it, it's a internal performance. It's real. You know, yeah. I think Murray and Williams, especially Williams, I think a lot of comics who want to break into the movies. That's I think what the goal is, especially in Williams, to be able to have that range of really funny, really mindless, goofy stuff. What we love Robin Williams, but man, he did a lot of bad films. But he also did a lot of really good films.
He did, and obviously, I think most people would agree that the good of his career far, far outweighed the bad.
And I think, but it was one of those, especially for our age. I remember talking about this when he died. We set the bar so high for him.
Yeah.
Especially those of us who had been following him since TV and stand-up, and you expect a home run every time, or at least a stand-up triple. And if it falls short, it's a real letdown. And I think we do that. There's a number of artists that you expect, and I think your auteur theory. If it's a director I like, it's got to be a slam dunk every time.
Yeah, that's the problem. But you know, no one hits 1,000%.
That's right.
No one bets 1,000. I'm just playing my
other sports cliches.
My best baseball acumen right there. Nobody's. I mean, you know, Robert Altman made Ready to Wear, which gets my lowest unofficial ranking of unwatchable,
really?
Literally unwatchable movie.
You know, that's not even the worst Altman film.
You know, Spike Lee made Clockers. Unwatchable.
Oh, come on. That's not that. But I think Girl 6 is worse.
Girl
than 6
is worse, but also unwatchable. You know, and I wouldn't call it unwatchable. But, you know, even Alfred Hitchcock made Marnie.
And Topaz. And The Torn Curtain. yeah, late 60s is not the best time for Mr. Hitchcock.
You know, even Charlie Chaplin made King of New York or whatever it was called. Wasn't that his last film, King of New York?
No, he did A Countess in Hong Kong.
That was it.
No, I actually want Charlie Chaplin to do an Abel Ferrara film, that you brought that up with Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
Jeez. No, we love titles here, especially when they bump into each other. Also opening in theaters today, if you head over to the Art Cinema, you know, the one with the bar, is Force Majeure.
Yeah, now this is a Swedish film, and it's about a Swedish family vacationing in France, having a very high-end skiing vacation. This is one of those ones where, like, you know, they set off cannons to have controlled avalanches to keep the powder just so, and, you know, very, very, you know.
Are you sure this isn't Miami in the 80s?
No.
Okay.
But anyway, so during one of these controlled avalanches, so to speak, people think like it gets kind of out of hand, and they think a real avalanche is happening. And I won't describe the events because it's one of those movies you really kind of have to experience what transpires to really get it. But, you know, it has a profound effect on this family, you know, just, you know, husband and wife, you know, son and daughter. And ends up reordering the entire family dynamic of just this, you know, seemingly bizarre, you know, at once terrifying, but then obviously, you know, in the end, harmless event. And it's just a really fascinating character study. And I think it's going to be discussed heavily for Best Foreign Language Film.
It is Sweden's submission for this year's Academy Awards, filmed in France. Yeah, I'm reading off
It's Swedish, but it's in France.
That's okay. It's all European. That's fine. So anyway, that is also opening in...
But don't the Swedes also use the franc, the Swedish franc, for their...
I thought it was a euro.
Well, back in the day when they had real money.
As opposed to the fake money.
Weren't there Swiss francs and French francs?
Yeah, I think so.
Or francs, as they would say.
Or freedoms, if you're in America. All right. So, anyway, besides those, there's lots of, I mean, like I said, we're in grown-up movie season. So you have The Theory of Everything, The Homesman, Birdman, Whiplash, films that I know we'll be talking about over the weekend.
Whiplash. I love me some Whiplash.
I do love Whiplash. All hail J.K. Simmons, basically.
Yeah, I was having this with you or another person, but like, you know, like, so they were saying J.K. Simmons has the best supporting actor Academy Award locked up. And I was like, as much as I would love that to be true, I don't know, because not many people have seen the film.
And this is one we're just going to be screaming about it. So this is hoping people make more notice of this picture.
Well, I thought Sam Rockwell was just so amazing in The Way, Way Back last year. And you know, there was actually like this campaign to try to get him a nomination that did not end up working out. But this could be one of those ones. I mean, you know, hey, when it comes to, you know, things that don't make sense, the Academy Awards are right there. You know, Paul Giamatti, not nominated for Best Actor for Sideways. Two of his co-stars were. How insane is that?
I know.
So, I mean, if J.K. Simmons does not get nominated,
we're gonna be angry, doughy white guys.
We will be unhappy campers. We'll be unhappy campers in the sense that we're, you know, too old and flabby to actually go camping. We'll be unhappy.
We will be unhappy on our front porch, just giving you stink eyes. You walk past.
Yes.
You didn't see Whiplash. It's your fault. It's not our fault. It's your fault. So, yeah, that's it. I wish I'd come up with this, because I, walking out of Whiplash, I said it was either, if you combined Black Swan with the first half of Full Metal Jacket, and somebody wrote Full Metal Juilliard, which I wish I had come up. That was pretty good. And the other one I wrote is if Lars von Trier directed Fame. I think that suits it best.
Wow.
Yeah. Ponder that.
Yeah. We didn't get to discuss Whiplash when it came out, but you know what makes... Quickly, what makes Whiplash go from being a really good to a great movie the third act of what happened.
The absurdity of what this kid is willing to do. And that's part of what is brought up is, you know, for somebody who's directed kids, and this one, it's a competitive big band. It's not really given to a thing. But there's a moment involving a car wreck.
Yeah.
And the kid still shows up. And you know, when the Simmons character says, you know, the most dangerous words in the history of the language are good job. And it's his job to make sure his band is great. Well, some people are cut out for that and some are not. I mean, the kid worships Buddy Rich, who is one of the most miserable band leaders in history.
Yeah.
Go on YouTube and you'll hear it. We can't play it here on the air.
I was going to say, he's so miserable that people actually recorded what a miserable SOB he was.
He was. And so, but yeah, the absurdity of what one person will do to be the best, to be the next Charlie Parker or the next Buddy Rich.
But I just love that third act, and I don't want to give it away in terms of...
Are you talking about the...
Where he comes back.
The lack of sheet music. I guess that's a good vague way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolute kick to the chest.
And you know, that to me, that's what is the difference between good movies and great movies is often what separates them is the ending. Because really good endings of movies are just totally satisfying and, you know, maybe bittersweet, maybe happy, maybe sad, but that work. They're like that once that ending comes, you say to yourself, there's no other way it could have ended. Those are really hard. Mm-hmm. The quick, abrupt, ambiguous endings, you know, like the director's cut ending.
I think of Limbo by John Sayles.
Yeah, the director's cut ending of Blade Runner where they just go into the elevator and it stops.
Yep.
Okay, that's easy. Anybody can make an ending like that. Because all you do is just stop. You pick an arbitrary point and you stop it and you say, it's ambiguous. And that's what they discussed in the film class, film theory classes. That's the easy way out. It's the cop... Which isn't to say movies can't have an ambiguous ending that's good, but it has to end.
Right.
And this very European thing of movies just stopping, I hate that because it's a cop-out.
End of Inception.
Love it.
Okay, just checking.
See, there's a great example of a deliberately ambiguous ending that does not wrap things up for the audience but is not meant to, but is fully satisfying.
There is, you know what, now that you mention that, there is a moment... It was actually not the moment, the final moment in Top 5. That's nice. It's not groundbreaking, but it's nice. The story of Cinderella is something that is brought up throughout the film, and it has a nice little bow at the end.
Yeah.
Whiplash. Yeah, go see Whiplash for crying out loud. It's been out there for weeks.
Yeah, it's made like $10 million.
It should make more. Well, then again, if I was running the world, this Whiplash would make Avatar money, and Albert Brooks would get $20 million a picture. But it's not.
Yeah.
And I'm not doing sitcoms with Christina Hendricks. So.
That is my go. My go. Just go see the darn movie of the year. Is people ask me. What should I see?
Go
what
see
haven't
Whiplash.
I heard of? Or blah, blah, blah. I say, go see Whiplash.
Go see Whiplash. All right. We're going to move to movies on DVD and Blu-ray. Obviously, I'm engineering the show because we don't have the DVD intro. I can't find it. It's Kobe's box of sound.
And the streaming and the pay-per-view.
Right. Yes. And all the...
Which, you know, we've not entered this phase where it's like the pay-per-view almost always comes out early now.
I think so. And, you know, and of course, those boxes that aren't phone boxes at your grocery store or your gas station. But to be fair, there was still a video store within a stone's throw of my house.
Wow.
So, and that's... And it's fun because there is a box that is a certain color nearby, and there is this place. So if one if I can't get it here, I can get it there. So I'm all right with that.
Yeah.
The big title out on Blu-ray this week, and it's one that it might be at the bottom half of my top 10. It was easily the most enjoyable film for me of the summer, and that's Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, most entertaining film of the year is probably a good way of putting it.
Fun.
Yeah, you know, we've seen 8 gajillion superhero movies. I know a lot of people are sick of them. I am not, but it was a lot of fun to see somebody go in a totally different direction and get away from all this, the dreariness and the grimness and,
the
you know,
seriousness,
and talking like this. And,
and superheroes as a Christ figure. And
yeah, and, you know, great power comes from great responsibility. And someone finally said, you know what? If I could do all this cool stuff, it would be a lot of fun, and I would enjoy it, and I would not, you know, complain about it.
And but so what you have is, I remember saying, because we have to compare it from another film or another, and this was... This was like an Ocean's 11 or even like a Dirty Dozens or Kelly's Heroes of this kind of group of misfits that have to work together to get the job done. And, you know, you have a green girl and a fox with the voice of Bradley Cooper, and you have Groot and
Raccoon.
Raccoon, and you have a wooden guy and a giant wrestler who's also of a different color who takes everything at face value.
Yes.
And Chris Pratt, who's become a huge star because of this. I think he's got the trip to Jurassic World because of this film.
Yeah, and Lego Movie.
And the Lego Movie, right. So
I love it when people, like the last person imaginable that you would think would become a not just a movie star, but a big movie star almost overnight does. It's like he's sort of like the Melissa McCarthy of 2014. It's
so just, he's going to fall down in a lot of films in the next 5 years. Sorry, Melissa.
We like you, Melissa.
I liked you a lot in St. Vincent.
She's terrific.
She's
in St.
really
Vincent.
Good in that.
Yeah.
Anyway, but Chris is in this, and it's not you, Chris, other Chris. But it's a lot of, and you don't need to see the other superhero movies.
You know,
I know it's got a Marvel label on it, but you don't worry about that. You don't need to worry about following, you know, the storylines of these characters. This is I think that's the other reason why it's enjoyable. It is a fine film in and of itself.
Yeah. So, and it's, I like to say it's the superhero comedy movie.
Yes.
That's straight comedy.
Fun.
Although my one complaint about the movie is the first 5 minutes has this opening sequence, like, if you know, the whole deal is he was on Earth and he got kidnapped and, you know, was a space guy the rest of his life, grew up.
He's the space cowboy.
So all he knows of Earth is the night, you know, like little 1980s cues, because that was
and
when he was a
bad
kid.
Bad 70s music.
Yeah. But it has this like 5 minute opening sequence that is like really almost disturbing and dark. And, you know, kid ripped from his mother's breast and, you know, really, you know, parent-child, you know, disassociation, you know that I watched the rest of the movie, you know, and loved it so much. And I was just like, that was so great. What the heck was with that first 5 minutes? Because it had just did not fit with the rest of the movie.
I would say it was almost as dark as the opening scene in The Secret Lies of Bees.
Yeah.
Where the daughter accidentally shoots and kills the mom.
Yeah. All I can say is I'm glad that 5 minutes was at the beginning of the movie. Not, imagine if it had been at the end of the movie. It would just been like, what the heck?
It would have been Lars von Trier directing a Marvel movie. So, and the other thing of note, besides Batista, pro wrestler Batista, being really funny, and guys, you get to see Zoe Green and Blue in the span of a few years. You're welcome. But Vin Diesel's film career, two of his best performances are animated.
Yeah, and he did not do the motion capture for Groot. He only did the voice,
just as
he did for the Iron Giant, and was fantastic.
And he's
in
great.
That too.
And it should be fair also, he was great in Find Me Guilty. Which is a good courtroom drama.
Yeah,
not
great, but
one,
good movie.
But he's really good in it.
Anybody who said, you know, like, oh, Vin Diesel, he's just a big muscle head. Can't act. Go rent Find Me Guilty. He's terrific in it.
Directed by the late, great Sidney Lumet.
Yes.
And Peter Dinklage is in that film as well. So go look for that. So Guardians of the Galaxy is out there. So you really should see that just to be a fan of cinema. Dolphin Tale 2, did you see that? No, were there questions left unanswered from the first one?
No, and I say I did not see the first one, so I did not go to the screening of the second one.
Ooh, yeah, you don't want to get lost.
It conflicted with something else. But the story back then was about a dolphin who loses its tail and then gets a prosthetic device to help with some cool humans.
We wound up seeing the first one, and then I checked in with the 13-year-old, and she's like, nah, I'm good.
Yeah, it's sort of the anti-Blackfish movie. You know,
no, wow.
it's like no animals in captivity. Totally awesome.
Nice. Okay. Also out on Blu-ray, and you saw this When the Game Stands Tall.
Yeah, did a decent little movie that sports movie that did some decent little amount of business earlier this year. Not too many people saw it. I thought it was one of the best sports movies I've seen in recent years, mainly because it's like the whatever is considered the genre of sports movie. This was like the anti. Of that.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's an anti-sports movie. I'm saying it's an anti-sports movie. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does.
It's like all the tropes and familiar cliches. This does the opposite.
And Christ is your coach.
Right. It's the story of true story of a football team in California that had not lost a game for 11 years. Think about that.
So were they as insufferable as the 72 Dolphins?
Almost. But so the movie opens with them, you know, or it begins with the end of the streak, not the beginning,
right.
And they lose their game, and then they lose another game, and suddenly it seems like they've completely lost, you know, all of their heritage, and it you know, and the coach has an ailment and can't coach, and it looks like it's going to be the end of the thing, and instead of it being taking the classic taking a bunch of misfits and turning them into a winning team,
the Mighty Ducks, or something.
This is taking the powerhouse team, breaking them down, and seeing what it really takes to become great again. It's a movie that's not about being the individual hero. It's about sacrificing for the team rather than being the star of the team. And it's based on a book by, I forget the author, but...
That's right.
Really terrific movie. Not a lot of people saw. I would highly recommend
When
the Game Stands Tall.
Okay, well, that's out there. Cavalry, which...
You've seen Me Not.
I really enjoyed it. Brendan Gleeson is a priest who finds out in confession that somebody in the small Irish village that he works in, the anonymous voice was molested by a priest, not Gleeson, and that priest died. But he wants to take revenge out on humanity, so he's going to take out in 1 week a good priest, played by Gleeson, and it's part whodunit, part small town. The UK small town drama where all the characters are quirky, and Chris O'Dowd is in it among others, and also a pretty solid look at faith, and not of the, you know. The films that beat you over the head with the message. I mean, it poses some serious questions about faith and what we use with it and how we stand by it. Gleason's really good in it. I don't think enough people have seen it. I got a feeling we might be bringing it up a little bit during the meeting, but it's one of those more people should check it out. And there's also some dark comedic moments, like we were talking earlier. And I think you can have jokes in a film that involves faith in a priest and it not being a complete and utter black comedy. Although it helps that if your brother wrote in Bruges, so there's a fun family right there. The Michael Fassbender film Frank is out, which I missed. And then I, Origins. Were you there for that? From the director of Another Earth.
Oh, no. This one with the little robot guy?
No. Frank is the one with the robot guy. I, Origins was the one where...
Frank is the one with... the actor,
Michael Fassbender.
Right.
Yes.
No, but who's the star of the film?
I thought it was Fassbender.
Okay.
Anyway, here we are, hard-hitting information.
iRobot is...
Oh, no, iOrigins.
iOrigins.
This was the director of Another Earth where the...
This is the little alien kid.
No.
Okay.
What are you...
I'll be quiet now.
You're throwing me off, man. You're the guest.
I'm still. We're dropping all the spinning plates at the moment.
That's fine. Give my best to Topo Gigio. Old titles out on DVD, now on Blu-ray. Sometimes things fall into odd places, and I'm a big fan of Criterion. Their treatment of films are fantastic, even if you know nothing about the film or even don't like the film. I mean, they put out two Michael Bay films on Criterion. And sometimes I wonder how they organize the release dates for certain films. Sometimes you get, like, you know, two Swedish movies or two Charlie Chaplin films or something that sort of has a link. Criterion put out three films on Blu-ray this week, and, well, one of these is not like the other, and we really don't recommend watching two of these together. First is Terry Gilliam's Time Bandits. That's the fun one.
I love Terry Gilliam.
Yeah, that's
even when he fails gloriously.
And he, like Sinatra, does it his way. The other one is the 1995 Julianne Moore drama Safe.
Yeah.
That's the one where it was a kind of a major breakthrough performance for her. She's allergic to everything, and she's trying to, you know, her life as a generic housewife is forever changed.
I think it was the movie that really established her as a lead actress. She kind of just been supporting up.
Yeah, from director Todd Haynes, and also from 1974, The Night Porter.
Yeah.
Charlotte Rampling and is it Dick Bogarde, where she finds a guy who was her tormentor
during the Holocaust. Jewish, yeah.
And they form a really 70s Euro film relationship.
Yeah.
Not a date film.
No.
Not a date film by any stretch of the imagination. And I tell you, Safe and Night Porter, not a good double feature.
Wow.
I don't recommend that to anybody.
I don't care who you are, how stable you are, you would be on suicide watch after a double bill of those.
Yeah, that's curl up in a ball in the fetal position for that one. And it's we've had double feature screenings of films in the past. I remember we were talking about this at the last screening last week. But I always remember there were two double headers that we had, and I thank God that we put them in this order, because if they had flipped it, we'd be in trouble. First one was we saw Up in the Air and then The Lonely Bones.
Oh.
Yeah, the Shonen Ronin Dead Girl film. Lovely Bones.
Lovely Bones.
Lovely Bones, sorry. So, yeah, Up in the Air.
We're not working the titles well today.
No, we're not. And the Lonely, and then there was a Single Man and then Nine.
Wow.
Going from Fellini-esque musical to Brit guy trying to kill himself. But it was in the reverse order. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
By the way, Lovely Bones, a lot of people did not like it. Stanley Tucci, amazing in that.
I still think Tucci should have been nominated for Julie and Julia.
Yeah.
That year.
Yeah.
I thought that was, anyway.
He was really good in general. But
his character screamed child molester with his making of dollhouses and the caterpillar mustache and his odd vocal quirks.
And he was blonde. Because whenever we want to show a male character who's insane or foppish or anything like that, they turn him blonde.
Really? Or they get Paul Bettany.
Yeah.
Chris has a crusade, ladies and gentlemen, in case you haven't figured that out. No, it's fine. Okay, so those are out on Criterion. Also out on DVD and actually on Blu-ray. And I always ask the question, do you need these films on Blu-ray? And if you do, are there lots of bonus goodies that, you know, so you're not just buying a DVD all over again? But from 1986, Running Scared. This was the cop buddy movie with Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines.
Right.
Jimmy Smits was the villain. Peter Hyams, I believe, directed that. And shot in Chicago, which I always remember is the stories where it was filmed in Chicago in the dead of winter, but there was no snow. So they would put shaving cream on the trees to make it look cold. You have a personal issue with the film. You are, besides being a member of the Film Me Up, you are also car enthusiast.
Yeah. Now, by the way, I should say that I did not dislike that movie at all. I thought Hines and Crystal have great
buddy cop rapport
in that movie.
Yes.
A lot of fun. But yes, in the course of making that film, they destroyed a 1969 Ford Mustang, which is a crime against cinema and humanity and Detroit.
Well, that's why Detroit went to hell in a handbag. No, it's not. Also out on DVD and Blu-ray, I remember seeing this with my dad from 1976. This was a majorly hyped film because it was the only time Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson worked together in an odd Western called The Missouri Breaks.
Yeah.
Directed by, I just had a brain freeze. We're hard hitting here at
This is why we really need to have, like, you know, like
Kobe.
Like, yeah.
It's terrible. But it was.
I'm pretty sure that is currently sitting in my Netflix DVD queue.
You've never seen it?
Nope.
Arthur Penn. Gosh, yeah, sorry, Arthur. Jeez. Randy Quaid, Frederick Forrest, and Brando plays an Irish hitman going after Nicholson. And there's if you look on, I remember there was a famous photo spread in Rolling Stone. He's in drag for a few moments. This was just when nobody wanted to work with Brando.
Yeah, Arthur Penn, who, like Sam Peckinpah, had a brief but amazing golden period.
Agreed. Also out on DVD and Blu-ray, Buffalo Bill and the Indians, speaking of Robert Altman, starring Paul Newman, Harvey Keitel, Joel Grey, Geraldine Chaplin, of course, and he plays... Newman plays Buffalo Bill, and it's a revisionist Western, and it's a story where there is a Wild West show, and it's also Sitting Bull is a part of the show, and it's kind of who's in charge and who really got the upper hand. You know, kind of this was, I think, the film he did after Nashville. And by the way, Nashville had a really nice Criterion treatment a few months back. But anyway, that's what I need to check out again. I know Newman and... Trivia, Paul Newman and Robert Altman worked together twice. Do you remember the other one? And I thought this was the worst Altman film.
No.
That's my hit. Quintet.
Oh, boy.
The futuristic game thriller from 1979, I think. Also out on Blu-ray, the third installment of Oliver Stone's Vietnam trilogy, Heaven and Earth.
Oh, yeah.
With Tommy Lee Jones. Inherit the Wind.
Oh, yeah.
Frederick March, Spencer Tracy.
The classic... courtroom drama movie.
Kobe's not here to defend my cousin Vinny. Forget him. It's Inherit the Wind.
Yeah.
I always, to this day, still, because we mix art and sport here at Film Sociology, but Frederick March and Spencer Tracy is a heavyweight boxing match. That's 15 rounds, heavyweight acting going on, and they're amazing
and
in the film.
Big topics, you know, God and man and humanism and faith and big... I mean, you know, an intellectually hefty movie by Hollywood
and
standards.
Your judge is Harry Morgan, and the defendant is Dick York, and there's Gene Kelly in his best non-musical role as Hornbeck. There's been a couple of remakes done of it. I still enjoy watching it, the remakes as well, but it's great watching March and Tracy go at each other. Also out from 1969, she won her first Academy Award for this, The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie with Maggie Smith.
Wow.
A woman who runs a very popular teacher at a Scottish boarding school. From 1975, another big box office disappointment with Jack Nicholson, The Fortune.
Hmm.
The teaming of Warren Beatty, Jack Nicholson, and Stocker Channing. And they're two, if I remember right, they're two con men that go after Channing, who they think is a very wealthy target. Also from the mid-70s, Funny Lady, Barbara Streisand's sequel to Funny Girl. Nobody needed it. And then Yentl, her big, which it's a good film, not a great film, but she, of course, directed that and went to rabbinical school and posed as a boy.
Was that her first directorial effort?
That was her first directorial effort. And I remember there was a lot of push about she should get a lot of nominations for it. It was beautifully done. Not enough people saw it. And a lot of people don't like Babs. So, sorry. But it is good. It is good. I'm going to get to Dead People We Like because we don't have time for Dead People We Don't Like, and then I'll talk a little bit about the film yet. But Marianne Mobley passed away at the age of 77, died on December 9th. And I think, as it's listed, one of the few Miss Americas to actually have a career after winning the crown, 1959. So I went through, and, you know, a lot of TV in the 70s and 80s, but she was the girl in not one but two Elvis movies. Not too many people can claim. Well, Shelley Fabre. But she starred in Harum Scarum, which is one of Elvis's really lesser efforts from 1960. This is me saying this. It's a lesser Elvis movie.
I was going to say, I hate to say it, but, you know, all Elvis Presley movies are, you know, lesser efforts.
No, that's not true. King Creole, Jailhouse Rock, Flaming Star, right, Loving You, They All Want to Talk, and Viva Las Vegas. And the concert films.
It depends on how you want to watch it.
But I still think I've had the show. I had Matt Tully in here, who's a big Elvis freak, and we immediately got rid of a third of Elvis's filmography, and it would still been a hell of a lot better.
Okay.
But she was in that. She was also in Girl Happy, which is Elvis and his butt. Guess what? He's a singer, and he's hired by a club owner of questionable standards of ethics to follow his daughter while she goes on spring break. So it's Elvis and Spring Break. There you go.
There you go.
And the motel manager, John Fiedler. Because you have to have one, like, token sort of name, that guy, or comedic sidekick, or the foil of some kind. But then she would do films like Three on a Couch, The King's Pirate, For Singles Only, Get Yourself a College Girl, which I actually watched on TCM. A lot of TV. Did The Partridge Family, Perry Mason, was on Mission Impossible, Love America Style. Who wasn't on Love America Style? The TV series version of Born Free, if you need that. Vegas. He was on Fantasy Island, Different Strokes, Love Boat, and so on and so forth. So, but anyway, yeah, two Elvis movies. There's that. Now, over at the Film Me Up, because Joe, if Joe were here, he'd say, you know, a little of this, a little of that. But you did in your Reeling Backs column, and it was a film, it was last week, and I was really glad you brought it up, from 1970, the Sam Peckinpah film, The Ballad of Cable Hogue.
Yeah, not a lot of people have seen it. It was a huge commercial, disaster at the time.
It was his follow-up to The Wild Bunch, and
right.
Expectations were really high on what he was going to make next.
From a commercial standpoint, it was kind of like the highs and the lows right in the course of just 1 year there. The movie more or less effectively ended his career as a independent auteur.
I would say Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid did that.
That's probably true, but let's just say he had a harder time finding work after this movie.
Yeah, because his follow-up, he went to England and made Straw Dogs.
Yeah.
Folks, not a date film.
Yeah.
Cable Hogue is a date film by comparison. Jason Robards plays a grizzled old coot who gets a water claim, and he's got to fight off L.Q. Jones and Strother Martin, and he gets the woo Stella Stevens. Not bad for 1970.
Yeah, and so it's a comedy. For the
as,
most
as
part,
funny as Peckinpah could
as
be.
As Peckinpah could be. As for those movies, for those who know Peckinpah, your first blush of like seeing the movie or hearing about the movie would be like, that can't be a Sam Peckinpah movie, but it is.
There's some slow motion scenes.
His fingerprints are all over it. It's a really interesting juxtaposition of The Wild Bunch and then The Ballad of Cable Hogue. People who followed the Reeling Backward column, which is to say Matthew and maybe one or two others.
That's not true. More people do.
I tend to actually shy away from big, famous films just because, for the most part, the effort is my ongoing film education. So I'm mostly trying to see movies I've not seen before. It's probably 95% movies I've not seen before. This is not in this case. I had seen Ballad of Cable Hogue, but many years before. But, it's just this idea of, should I write about – why would I write about this instead of about The Wild Bunch? Well, people have literally written whole books about The Wild Bunch.
Yes, and I have them.
I'm not really sure what I could say, in all true humility, I could say about The Wild Bunch that someone else hasn't already said. But, so I tend to seek out little movies like this. So what can we say about The Ballad of Cable Hogue as it relates to The Wild Bunch?
And the end of the Old West is a similar theme.
Yeah, a very common theme in that. But it's essentially in The Wild Bunch, he essentially destroyed the Western as a genre. Just sort of deconstructed it and dynamited it and blew it
in
to smithereens.
Slow motion. Yes.
In slow motion. So where do you go from there? Well, you end up making this sort of gentle little comedy with some more somber notes to it, and it's a movie that seems very inconsequential when you watch it, but as it goes on and as you contemplate it, I think there's a lot of deeper themes there.
Because I know I'm going to flex my nerd muscles here as far as Peckinpah. Yeah, there's Cable Hogue. Then he made Straw Dogs in England, not a date film. Then he had two Steve McQueen films. He did Junior Bonner, which is a really fun story about an aging bull rider rodeo film with Robert Preston. Didn't do well. And then he made The Getaway, which was his big popcorn film with Steve McQueen and Ally McGraw. And because of that, he then made Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, and he clashed with the studios, and they fired him after finished filming so they could make a cut. And now there is a definitive cut, and I still like the film.
Yeah.
And then, that and cocaine really just kind of finished Peckinpah for the rest of the decade. So
yeah.
There is that. But no, so and then this week you wrote about?
I believe it was Night of the Iguana.
Oh, yes. John Huston. You have big names. John Huston, Richard Burton, Tennessee Williams,
Ava Gardner,
Sue Lyon.
Yeah.
Deborah Carr.
Yeah. I didn't like it. I didn't like it all that much. It's we were discussing, I referenced in the thing on the Wikipedia page, they thought that James Garner was originally offered the role, and he turned it down because he said it was too Tennessee Williams for me. And after I watched it, I think this is one of those movies that it probably works. It works really well on the stage, and it just does not translate well to film.
Yeah, Burton plays a priest who has lost his path.
Lost his path, and he's now down in Mexico doing these
tours and things with Sue Lyon.
Not so much hitting on the women folk as resisting the advances of the women folk.
Yeah, because she was already in Lolita.
The underage women folk.
All right, so folks can go check out Chris's stuff at the Film Yap, and Monday. Monday we will have the IFJA Awards.
The announcements will be out.
Or you can go to IndianaFilmJournalistAssociation.com. We are a com, yes. And then next week's show is my birthday. Moo-hoo-ha-ha-ha. So, ladies and gentlemen, words to live by. Soylent Green is people, and Zardoz has spoken. And somebody get Ed Johnson out of Zardoz belt buckle, please. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Happy trails, Kobe. Go Lions and go Red Wings. And Pistons are god awful, but go anyway.
And Pacers, please try.
And be trying.
Be trying.
See you later.